Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Politicians in Britain and Northern Ireland are on the election trail, and it's been a week full of drama with campaign launches and resignations and talk of unusual electoral pacts. On the line to tell us more now, we have our regular political correspondent and commentator, Susan Phillips. You're very welcome back to the show, Susan. How are you?
Good morning, Raylan.
First of all, Susan, plenty of drama this week.
Well, there really has, and then you have to just set the scene a bit. I mean, we've had 3.5 years since the UK voted for Brexit. When I say we, it's because it affects all of us, and we all have to see what's going to happen. But the problem is that we have an election. They have an election due on the 12th of December because Boris Johnson doesn't have enough MPs to pass any new laws. So even his withdrawal agreement was stopped. So you'd think it'd be pretty straightforward with manifestos and launches and visiting hospitals, but actually this week's been really drama filled. And just as the Conservatives were launching their campaign, which was on Wednesday, Labour's Tom Watson, who, Ronan, you might remember, he was the Labour deputy head who nearly lost his position at the Labour conference recently.
Right.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, there was a surge against him, as it were. Yeah,
they couldn't sack him, so they said that they would remove the position of deputy head. But anyway, they didn't in the end. And he just bowed out. I mean, that's absolutely unheard of. So that was him gone. You had Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Tory we all know by his voice, and he was forced to apologise for a ridiculous comment he made about Grenfell Tower fire. He said, okay, the fire people said, stay where you are, and they shouldn't have done, and anybody in their right minds would have, like me, would have just gone out. You know, and it was just ridiculous. So
he said, if you or I had been in that burning building, we would have run, wouldn't we? He said something like that.
Well, it was just unnecessary, and if that wasn't enough, four ex-Labour MPs, you probably know some of them, Ian Austin, John Woodcock, Tom Harris and Michael McCann. Yeah. We may not remember them, but anyway, not only did they say they wouldn't vote for Jeremy Corbyn because they said he was unfit to lead, they said so much would they not vote, they'd vote for the Tories. So it's been that sort of a week.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. And more people yesterday, the chairman, the Tory chairman from Pudsey stepping down and saying, I'm going to be voting for Jeremy Corbyn. So it's almost like I've never, ever known a British election like it. We're already about 2 days in or 3 days in, and it's already crazy.
It really is. You see, when Boris, his main line, when he launched the campaign, he said that Parliament was paralysed over Brexit, and that the withdrawal agreement had delivered everything I campaigned for, and it was blocked. So it's all very divisive because Labour had launched their campaign on a promise of a new deal with Brussels. I mean, going back to Brussels again, and then they said they'd put it to the people in a referendum, and they're accused of sending mixed messages. I mean, obviously, we all know that originally Corbyn was a Leaver. So now, what is he now? And then, so you could say that on the whole, the Conservative Party obviously the Brexit Party we'll talk about, they're Leavers. The Lib Dems and the Scottish National Party are staunchly Remainers.
Absolutely.
And now we see that the Lib Dems, Plaid Cymru and the Green Party formed a pact, a Remainers pact, agreeing not to stand against each other in 60 constituencies.
And do you think that will work at all?
I think it probably will, but pacts, yes, I think pacts often do work. And then we can talk about the Northern Ireland pacts, if you like, which are
absolutely
even stranger.
Let's do that, yeah, because there was an extraordinary situation where Sinn Féin decided to stand aside for Lady Sylvia Herman, and then what happened?
Well, basically, you've got to remember that Brexit is just as divisive in Northern Ireland, and they actually voted 56% to leave. But the DUP, who had supported the Conservatives, as we know, they just felt that the recent withdrawal agreement had literally thrown them under the bus. You know, that was the one that Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson had at the last minute agreed. And they just say that by having a border down the Irish Sea, they in the North will no longer feel a part of the UK. So it's very contentious. It's quite interesting because in the pact, the SDLP have said they won't contest North Belfast in the hope of aiding Sinn Féin's chance of unseating Nigel Dodds. He's the DUP deputy leader. And Sinn Féin have reciprocated by saying they won't contest South Belfast to help the SDLP take another DUP seat. And so it goes on. Now, the Alliance Party, actually, Naomi Long, has said that, well, she would obviously support Lady Sylvia Herman, but I think yesterday we saw that Lady Sylvia Herman has said she's not standing at all, haven't we?
Yeah, and I think that's it's so weird because, I mean, the notion of Sinn Féin saying, look, just strategically, we'll allow you sit this out without checking in with her first to see if she was going to stand.
Yes, now, whether she made a last-minute stand, we don't really know. But
yeah,
you have to remember that Sinn Féin have this long abstentionist pact. And so people are being asked to vote for them, knowing categorically that they will not go to Westminster.
Yeah.
You know, and added to that, we're talking about, I think we're nearly up to 3 years, aren't we, since the Assembly's being empty.
Yes,
yes, we are. I think we're a month away from the third anniversary of the collapse of power sharing.
Yeah.
You know, it is such a mess up there.
Yeah.
And again, you have to remember that 56% of the people in Northern Ireland wanted to remain, and businesses and agricultural sectors have warned that there would be a catastrophic economic consequence if there was a no deal and a crash out. So again, they're very divided up there.
Bringing it back to Britain, to GB, as they say up north, Is it strange, do you think, that, you know, we have this electoral pact between, you know, the three smaller parties, that would consider themselves to be Remain, you know, the kind of the Plaid, the Liberals, and the Green Party, and we have that going on, but the biggest Remain party, and I use that in inverted commas,
yes,
is Labour, and Labour are having nothing to do with that electoral pact. Do you think that kind of undermines the idea of an electoral pact, or do you think Labour should maybe have gone into that electoral pact, or what do you think?
I think that the majority of Labour voters will be Remainers, so we'll have to see whether some of those fringe places, like we're going to talk about my West Hartlepool in a minute, it depends how they go. I would say PACs are all looking to the future. So say, for example, at the moment, and all the polls vary, Ronan, but they're saying the Conservatives are about 8% ahead. Now, if they are, if that's true, then they probably won't, they won't need to do a pact with everybody. But are the Lib Dems secretly looking towards doing a pact with Labour later? You see, they might be. Now, Jo Swinson had said, probably shouldn't have done, she had said that she would support Labour in a future government, but only if Jeremy Corbyn wasn't there.
Yes.
So,
yeah,
you know, how, what would you do about that pact?
Yeah, I know, and like, and the problem is, of course, that Jeremy Corbyn is greatly loved within certain parts of Labour, and that could really create problems for her, I suppose.
Yeah, but when you actually see that Alan Cairns, the Welsh Secretary, he stood down as well. He said that he had to stand down because he was the Tory one. He said that he had got some sort of mess up and been accused of supporting a trial. So, you know, he's gone. So but you have to remember that he was the Welsh Secretary, but the Conservatives have lost quite a lot of members too, haven't they?
Of course,
you know, I think 10 got back their whip. 10 of the 21 were reinstated. But this, you know, Boris Johnson has lost a lot of his people.
Yeah, well, this is it. Did I hear the other day that Boris Johnson only has like a 5% lead in Uxbridge? So I heard this guy from Labour just going, "It's only 5%, folks. You know, we could topple him, and that would be the end of everything." You know, it's absolutely hilarious.
You see, the polls do vary. You know, quoted one where they said he had a Tories had an 8%, but you know, I don't think anybody knows. But really, what we're looking at. Any power of the Brexit Party. Now, the Brexit Party have said quite definitely the present deal of Johnson, it doesn't take back British sovereignty, it doesn't give them control over their economy. I think he was quite weak when he announced his manifesto, quite honestly. But what he's going to do is, he originally had said to the Tories that maybe we should have a pact, but Boris Johnson wasn't having any of it.
Right.
So this is what Farage is going to say, and he is saying. He's saying that he is going to stand, wait for it, you know, I always quote Hartlepool.
Yes,
he
indeed
is going to stand in West Hartlepool, his candidate, not him, because he, Farage, isn't standing anywhere. But a Labour guy, it's a Labour seat. It's been a Labour seat, West Hartlepool, for 56 years, as we know, but they voted 70% to leave. So they're very, very vulnerable. So we've got this Brexit chairman who's called Richard Tice, who apparently, so they say, is a multimillionaire property tycoon. And he has said, I am going to stand as a Brexit candidate in the Labour-held seat of Hartlepool, because so many Hartlepool people.
Yeah.
So you could say, okay, he could win that, but what about the Conservatives? Because Boris Johnson has said right from the beginning, I'm going to target any Labour seats in the northwest of England who voted out. So you've got this, well, or you could almost say a standoff between Brexit Party and the Tories, and that could result in seats remaining with Labour, which for West Hartlepool is could well be the case. So, you know, you're looking at so many different possibilities all round the place, aren't you?
Yeah, I could imagine for people who really, you know, who are part of the British political system, it must be kind of tear your hair out time. I mean, it has been, I'm sure, for 3 years, but it really is. You simply wouldn't be able to call this election really in any real way.
No, you wouldn't. And, you know, I've talked to colleagues in England who have, you know, probably all their lives voted one or the other. And now they're saying, you know, this two-party system of Labour and Tory, that's definitely, well, they think it could be on the way out, because say the Lib Dems, who've said categorically, we are Remainers. We're not arguing, we're just saying we are Remainers, and if we have any power, we're going to put an end to Article 50, which is the article that has Britain leaving. So you could say that in the end, this is a totally Brexit election, or you could say that Boris Johnson has won the hearts. But this is what some people are saying, that he might have won the hearts of enough people in Britain who are so fed up with everything. Yeah. And don't forget, people Ronan quite like a strong man, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. They might just say, look, we're just going to vote for Boris because he can deal with Brussels. We're fed up with the whole thing. Yeah. So we'll put the Tories in. But enough Tories have to go in that they don't need the DUP. They obviously, the DUP wouldn't join up with them again, would they?
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And I presume what this is all about is him trying to get himself a sufficient majority that he's not going to need them.
That's, yes, he can't need them because they won't back him. And and who else would? I don't think there's anybody else that would back him. So he's got to come out with a just about a clear majority. And then don't forget, poor Mrs. May, she went into that very ill-called election in 2017 thinking, I've got a little majority, I'll get a bigger one.
Yeah.
And look what happened to her.
The opposite,
she then had to form a get support from the DUP.
And you, on some level, there must be some possibility that there'll be another hung parliament.
Well, yes, there could be, but then maybe allowances will kick in, and then I suppose a lot will depend on what happens to Labour, because if Labour should, as the main party in opposition, they should be creaming it.
Yes,
shouldn't
they should. Of course they should.
But the dislike of Jeremy Corbyn, who is described by just about every analyst as being a Marxist, which isn't very...
And people don't like that. Yeah, that's too strong.
Like that,
yeah, that's too extreme. I agree with you. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
So, you know, he's saying he's going to abolish all public schools, and then he was up in York in 2017 because a friend of mine who's a student in York was actually listening, and he said to the students in York, this was for 2017, if I get in, which he didn't, I am going to abolish all third-level fees and... Actually, I'm going to return to you, because it's very expensive now in Britain, I'm going to return to you everything you've paid to date, if you haven't graduated. You know, and so people are saying, well, is this sort of rhetoric really going to attract the young? Or are the young going to say, well, actually, if there are no university fees, we won't be able to support good professors, so our standards will go down. You know, it'll depend, I think, a lot on the young people, because traditionally young people, you know, when we're young, we all are pretty left, most of us. And then we sort of get more to the middle. So we'll just see whether the young people will support Jeremy Corbyn.
It's a good point. And of course, we forget that since the referendum, there have been 3 full years of new 18-year-olds that have all come on the scene. So you never know what that way...
No, and they will be influential, definitely.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Like the much older group of people apparently always did vote out. You know, they want Britain to get back whatever the sovereignty is, they want it back.
Yeah.
Now, will they have changed? Will their sort of middle-aged children have said, no, you know, Mum, Dad, we actually want Remain?
Yeah, that's right.
There
could have been a change. Absolutely. Susan, wonderful talking to you, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. God bless you. Talk to you soon. Now, an issue that we hear more and more about in the media is euthanasia and assisted suicide. It's a topic that can be very emotive and also one that seems very complicated. And our next guest is involved with an upcoming conference run by Doctors for Life called The Case Against Euthanasia. And while euthanasia is not legal in Ireland, it is in other countries. So what we can learn from there, well, what can we learn from their experiences? On the line now to tell us more, we have GP Dr. Ronan Cleary. You're very welcome to the show, Ronan. How are you doing?
Good morning, Ronan. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good. So first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with Doctors for Life.
So my name's Dr. Ronan Cleary. I'm a newly qualified GP. I originally got involved with Doctors for Life in the run-up to the referendum there last year because my view on abortion is one of a pro-life perspective. So effectively, I went to a few conferences, I met people of a like-minded disposition, and I got involved with Doctors for Life. And effectively, I've been involved with them before the referendum and ever since. So I suppose that's how I got involved with Doctors for Life.
Sure. So I think most people probably know what euthanasia is, but for those of us and our listeners that don't know what the technical term means and also what the upcoming conference hopes to highlight, would you mind telling us?
So euthanasia is effectively the ending of life, of a person's life before natural death. It's termed in many ways euthanasia or assisted suicide. And I suppose the conference, which is on this on Saturday week, the 16th of November, in the Lyra Estate Hotel in Kilkenny, is to highlight the case against that practice. And Doctors for Life, who is running the conference and who I'm a member and part of, is effectively putting forward the case against euthanasia and why it's important to cherish all life at all stages, from conception to natural death. So euthanasia and assisted suicide, which is legal in many European countries, but not yet legal in Ireland or in the UK, is effectively the intervention by healthcare professionals to preemptively end a life for a myriad of number of reasons, whereas Doctors for Life would see that is actually anathema to us, whereas we see the importance of being doctors as to care for life at all its stages, no matter its subjective worth in the eyes of many people.
I was just thinking about this, Ronan, because I was thinking, you know, really the entirety of your training, you know, and the philosophy that you grow up through and all of the rest is all about preserving life and maintaining life and, you know, and helping people to survive things that otherwise would take their life. And suddenly this idea that you would be taking life, it seems very, very, I suppose, counterintuitive for somebody who has been trained as a doctor.
No, well, for me, it goes against every fiber of my being. I became a doctor because I wanted to help preserve life. I wanted to care for the vulnerable. As many people do in society, not just doctors, there's healthcare professionals, there's nurses, there's public health nurses, there's many people who are outside of the medical profession who care for their loved ones and relatives at every single stage of their life, and for many hours and with many emotions, and don't get paid for it at all. But I suppose what I had the opportunity to go into medicine and to study for medicine, and that inner thought is what binds me to the greater good of what is intrinsically valuable, and there's life itself. People nowadays sometimes do not hold the sanctity of life with as much respect as we may wish. But I suppose Doctors for Life is trying to bring and sort of coalesce the thought and the case against euthanasia and try and combat the idea that it is somehow compassionate or somehow beneficial to society, whereas in fact it's not, because in Doctors for Life, we believe that no matter the subjective view on that person or individual's life, all life is important, and that life itself is worth preserving, and that the doctor's job, his very first role, should be to preserve that life.
Yeah, I'll come back to talking to you about the conference in just a moment, but I suppose the difficulty arises, you know, again, taking a contrary view for a moment, the difficulty arises where we see that someone's, you know, I suppose their quality of life is so compromised, and you know that they may not, you know, the classic things that we're presented with in these difficult situations, that are difficult cases, as they say, you know, where somebody is really suffering, you know, in a tremendous amount of pain, isn't isn't conscious or isn't really aware. These are the kinds of situations that tend to come up where people say, surely, you know, compassionately, the family or our close friends should step in and help them end it. That's usually the kind, well, it's one of the kind of cases that are made. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, they are very sad cases, and they are very real cases. And I've seen cases like that in my professional job. But what I would say to people in difficult circumstances and who believe that euthanasia or assisted suicide is the way out is that life itself is precious. Whether you believe in God or not, life itself is precious, and the purpose of a doctor is to preserve life. Now, the people say that, like, you know, oh, you shouldn't preserve life at any cost. Well, I'm not saying that. Preservation of life should not be at any cost. There's many people that have what is called do not resuscitate orders, and yeah. Effectively you put comfort measures in place, there are medications available, and effectively if a person who is very sick or in a debilitated form or is bedridden and often have maybe a heart attack or a stroke, measures would not be put in place to intervene, sure, to try and revive that person, but to help them slip. The difference is euthanasia and assisted suicide is the deliberate killing of that individual, which is different from comfort measures, which doctors for life have no issue with.
You mentioned earlier on the fact that euthanasia, obviously it's not legal in Ireland, but it is in other countries. What is the current landscape in other Western countries in related to assisted dying and euthanasia?
Well, I suppose the most high-profile place where it's legal at the moment is probably countries like Switzerland and Belgium. Where we hear stories, difficult stories of people being euthanized, quite young people being euthanized for different conditions that people may not, in hindsight, or people may not in this country think that would warrant, or in any way, shape or form, that their life be taken. So for intractable depression, I heard or read of a case that there was a young lady in Belgium that had what's euthanized for intractable depression. Now, I find that completely anathema that someone would have their life taken for that. And I question the ethos of the medicine in Belgium, where a lady has no option but to take her own life because of a condition such as that, and where the input of the medical profession or the caring input of the medical profession isn't put in to try and help that person. So, I mean, I suppose, like, I'm just worried now I'm concerned that that something similar could come into this country, and also who would be asked to euthanize or sure. to assist in the suicide of those patients.
It's always doctors, isn't it? Yeah. I love the way they brought in this adoption, or the abortion law, should I say. They brought in an abortion law. They didn't really consult with the people who were going to have to be doing it, you know? And I thought that was kind of very, very weird.
The ICGP and the government did not consult with GPs on the ground, and to all intents and purposes it was foisted onto GPs.
Yeah.
Now there are GPs that are willing and do abortions, but the overwhelming majority objected to abortion in primary care and made their voices and their feelings very clear to the ICGP. But they were completely ignored.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was more than completely ignored. They were kind of, it was almost, how dare you, having a contrarian view here. The people have voted, instead of going, well, actually, I'm a person and I'm allowed to decide what I want to do with myself, you know, whether I'm a GP or not, you know. I'm not prepared to behave or act in a way that's contrary to my own personal value system. And it's very, and people are saying, well, you have to. I mean, where else are you going to get somebody being forced to do something that's against their own moral compass, you know? Can I just I was going to ask you a question, you know, to do with euthanasia. Sorry, I just went off on one there. It's not to do with euthanasia, but I was going to ask you, you know, again, and maybe it's a little bit kind of close to what we were talking about just in terms of abortion. Do you think that as countries experience increased pressure on their health services, you know, with aging populations, that there might be a kind of a slow creep, you know, where there's kind of increasing calls for laws about allowing euthanasia because they've more older people or something?
Well, that could happen. That, of course, it would never be an official policy, but it could happen even in people's thoughts or the narrative or the outlook on life.
Sure.
Because once you cheapen life and once you bring a euthanasia and you bring assisted suicide into a country and you try to normalize it, it becomes normal and it becomes very difficult to question. That is what the current government and the ICGB have attempted to do with abortion. They've tried to normalize it, whereas in fact we know that it is not normal, it is simply the killing of an unborn child. So I think Judge Carney, actually, there was a Marie Fleming case there a number of years ago, and he effectively summed it up quite succinctly when he said, in opposing euthanasia, he said, and I'll just quote him, he said, even with the most rigorous system of legislative checks and safeguards, it would be impossible to ensure the aged, disabled, the poor, the unwanted, the rejected, the lonely, and the impulsive, the financially compromised and emotionally vulnerable would not avail of this option in order to avoid a sense of being a burden on their family and society.
Exactly.
Now, that is something that we have to avoid at all costs in this country.
Absolutely.
It is very, very important that we do so, and we cannot accept that euthanasia and assisted suicide is a normal practice of medicine, notwithstanding all the difficult cases that are out there. If we do open it up and legislate for it, this is the risk that is very, very real that this could happen.
Yeah,
and Judge Carney spotted it many, many years ago in the Marie Fleming High Court case.
Yeah.
And it was very, very, very intuitive of him. And I think that the whole point of our Doctors for Life conference, again, I'll just plug it again, it's on Saturday, November the 16th at 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Lyra Hotel in Kilkenny. And it's €50 for non-medics. And I would encourage people listening to this program to maybe considering attending. There's a number of very good speakers coming over from England and homegrown speakers that are
going to support the case against euthanasia. Tell us who's speaking.
A young gentleman, a surgeon from the UK, Dr. Callum Miller. You may have seen him on the TV. He's a pro-life doctor from the UK. He's speaking on how did we get to where we are at, an overview of the euthanasia movement. That's the first speech, or the first talk. There's a Dr. Patrick Policino from the Liverpool Care Pathway. There's another young chap, a medical student, David O'Donnell. He's actually got a very interesting talk, Surviving the Shark Tank as a Pro-Life Student. Dr. Pada Tobin, actually, from AIM2, will be talking about the future of pro-life politics in Ireland. Because AIM2 is one of the few parties, as you know, who have come out as very much being a pro-life movement, and that is from conception to natural death. And we're lucky to have Pada Tobin giving a talk there on the future of pro-life politics in Ireland, because effectively the only way that we will turn this around is to have pro-life TDs from conception to natural death. There's another doctor there, Dr. Sinead Donnelly, about a palliative care consultant from New Zealand, giving a talk on about how when legislation on euthanasia looms. So I would I'd encourage anyone listening to this show today to come to the Lyra Hotel, Kilkenny, on November the 16th. Entrance fee can be paid on the door. But it's promising to be an interesting debate, an interesting talk, and we have more than, say, 8 or 9 very, very good speakers. And Lorcan Price, sorry, I didn't mention Lorcan. Lorcan Price, the barrister, will be giving the human rights angle on euthanasia as well.
Very good. So, actually, you're covering a lot of area there. So, the Lyrathos Estate Hotel, Kilkenny, it's tomorrow week, Saturday the 16th.
Tomorrow week.
It goes from 9:30 in the morning till 5:30 in the evening, so it's a full day. You've a special price for students of €20, which is very reasonable. And did you say it was €50?
That's correct. Yeah. It's actually from 9 a.m. But it's Saturday week, and it's €50 for non-medics. €75 for medics, and €20 for students.
Yeah, wow, wonderful, wonderful. Okay, GP Dr. Roland Cleary from Doctors for Life, thank you so much for talking to us today.
No, God bless you. Thank you.
www.irishdoctorsforlife.com, the upcoming Doctors for Life conference on the case against euthanasia takes place on Saturday the 16th of November at the Lyrath Estate Hotel, Kilkenny, which is a lovely spot. And Saturday the 16th, so that's tomorrow week, November, and it is from 9, as he says, 9 a.m. to 5:30 in the evening. Tomorrow, November 9th, is an interesting day for anniversaries. We've already heard in our news that it will be the 81st anniversary of Kristallnacht, but it's also the anniversary of a much happier event, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. 30 years ago. Our next guest was covering world events for Time magazine at the time, and he's on the line to share some of his memories. David Aikman, you are very welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ronan, for having me on.
First of all, David, those weeks in late 1989 were some of the most dramatic of the 20th century, weren't they?
They were. It was an extraordinary year. The Queen of England called it Annus Mirabilis for what happened in Eastern Europe. And it was much of what really was important in 1989 was triggered by the fall of the Berlin Wall itself and the fact that East Germans could suddenly flock over into West Berlin and into West Germany. It was amazing.
And what are your memories of the fall of the Berlin Wall? You were actually in Germany, but not in Berlin, am I right?
That's right. I was in Munich attending a foreign affairs conference. And the wall came down. And I had previously been a reporter covering Eastern Europe, so I knew that the next place to go was Czechoslovakia. So I cabled my editors and I said, you've got to send me to Prague because that's where it's all going to happen. And sure enough, the collapse of communism in Czechoslovakia, which was a very remarkable, a very moving time when you saw an entire people rising up against this rotten system that had kept them imprisoned for so long. And watching people like Václav Havel courageously stand up against the regime, and it basically fell down after 10 days. Quite extraordinary.
And you're right. I mean, because I was thinking, you know, Prague was the place in 1968 that rose up, and, you know, there was always a kind of feeling that if anything was going to go, it would be there first. But like you say, it still took tremendous courage, like from people like Václav Havel, to actually stand against them, because it wasn't a done deal by any manner of means, was it?
No, it wasn't. And I think the remarkable thing about Havel was that in the midst of the demonstrations against the communists, he made a very remarkable speech. He said, look, when we come to power, we must not have a witch hunt for communists under the bed and so forth. We mustn't report people who are secret policemen. And there was a pause, and then a crowd of 300,000 people, nobody directing, they all shouted back in unison, we are not like them. That sent chills up my spine because I thought, this is actually a moral revolution before it's a political revolution. It's a recognition that the values of the communist regime have been evil, and we are replacing them basically with traditional Christian ideas.
Wow, that's just extraordinary. Can I bring you back, actually, even before that, to that foreign affairs conference that you were at in Munich? I mean, it's very interesting that it was a foreign affairs conference in Munich, because, you know, most people seem to think that it really was quite sudden and unexpected. What was the response in the room when people began to realize this Berlin Wall was beginning to open up?
I mean, amazing. It was euphoric. I mean, they just, they couldn't, they had imagined it happening, but it was such a jolt from the blue. It had happened so suddenly that they couldn't actually grasp what had really happened. But then when they started seeing the stirring of demonstrations in Prague and throughout Czechoslovakia, they realized that the whole kit and caboodle was coming down, that communism was basically going to collapse. Because after all, you'd had trainloads of East Germans being allowed to leave the embassy grounds of West German embassies in East European countries. They had been allowed to travel to the West for several months. So Eastern Germany was draining itself of some of its most talented citizens.
Yeah.
And so the whole of the rest of Eastern Europe looked on with amazement and said, my gosh, we want some of that too.
And, you know, I'm trying to kind of almost picture myself back then. I was interrailing very shortly after that, about a month or two later, around, and it seemed like everybody I met on a train had a little piece of the wall in their backpack, you know, because that's what they all did. But I'm, you know, you were right there kind of almost as the thing was happening. And the fact that nobody people imagined it happening, but nobody could say this, they never saw it as being something imminent. So what do you think? think was the thing that finally made it happen in the end?
Well, I think it was what I would call a tipping point in the moral consciousness of the entire population of Eastern Europe. And it started off really in East Germany, because you had marches in Dresden, and the only place where the demonstrators could gather safely were in churches. And so the churches had comprised a major covering for all of the demonstrations that were happening. And the awareness in Prague that this was a moral revolution was not confined to Václav Havel himself. He wasn't even an acknowledged Christian. Mm. But everybody seemed to sense that this was absolutely the end of something evil. And in fact, Václav Mali, who was another member of the dissident group surrounding Havel, actually led the Lord's Prayer in a public stadium above the city several days after Havel had made that speech, and it had a dramatic effect on the crowd.
Wow. I've never heard any of this before. It's really extraordinary to actually realize just how kind of spiritual the revolution was in some ways when it comes to Czechoslovakia.
It was a moral revolution before it was a political revolution.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So going back to the Berlin Wall, what do you think was the significance of the moment of the fall of the Berlin Wall? Was it like a signal to the whole of the Eastern Bloc to go, this has come to an end? Do you think it was like a sign?
It was clearly a signal to the East German regime itself that it had fallen on hard times. It had absolutely no moral credibility. And that flickered the imagination of all of the other peoples. And of course, in Poland, you had the first pre-election in May of that year. And on May the 4th, which ominously enough was the day when the Tiananmen Square crackdown took place in China, the Poles for the first time elected a non-communist prime minister. So the whole thing was bursting into bloom in front of your eyes. It was just an astonishing experience.
And, you know, I was thinking, you know, there's an entire generation of young people now who are, you know, 20 plus now, who, you know, don't know anything other than Poland and Hungary and Czech and Slovakia, all part of the EU. And, you know, I often wonder, do we too quickly forget what our fellow Europeans have suffered during our own lifetime?
Well, I think we do forget. I think this is true of the whole of human history, not just any particular culture. Every generation tends to forget what happened to the previous generation.
Sure.
Doesn't learn the lessons that earlier generation learned. For example, the people of France and Britain in the 1930s were still traumatized by the nightmare of World War I, and they thought, we absolutely do not want war because it's going to be like World War I or even worse. And that's why you had this craven appeasement atmosphere that absolutely soaked into the body politic of Britain and France in the 1930s, broken only by the squawk of an unpopular right-wing politician called Winston Churchill. So, very interesting story.
Absolutely, yeah. So, it was always fascinating, David. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning. Author and former Time Magazine senior correspondent, David.
Thank you very much, Roland. Very nice to be on the program.
Talk to you again soon. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we talked to Paul McAree about a prayer initiative in Belfast, where 40 days and nights have been set aside to pray for Northern Ireland, with abortion legislation imposed there last month following a vote which took place in Westminster in July. Christians from across Ireland have been coming together at St. Mary's Church, Chapel Lane in Belfast to pray for the situation, and will continue to do so until the 15th of November. Now, on the line now to tell us how it's going, we have one of the organisers of the initiative, Paul McAree. You're very welcome to the show, Paul.
Good to be back.
Yeah, first of all, Paul, can you remind us what the initiative was about?
Yes, well, it was because of the imposition of abortion in Northern Ireland, which was a vote in Westminster back in the summer. The deadline, of course, was October the 21st. And so there was no consultation in Northern Ireland about this whatsoever, because our own government is unfortunately in abeyance at the moment. But But and they have an abortion regime that is right up to 28 weeks, really, for any reason, and is imposed in Northern Ireland. So if you can imagine this, before the 31st of October, Northern Ireland was the safest place in all of Europe for an unborn child. But now we find ourselves in a situation where it's the most dangerous place for an unborn child because of this imposition of really British law coming into Northern Ireland.
And that happened almost like a flick of a switch, because I was speaking to you on, if memory serves, on the Friday, and this was about to come in on the Monday. So was there tremendous disappointment in the Northern Ireland political parties that the Northern Ireland political parties weren't able to come together to stop this legislation?
Yeah, I think people were shocked, really, that our political representatives, you know, it has to be said, there wasn't one Catholic representative in defence of the unborn. And you know, Roland, we were talking last week about we were praying for a miracle.
Yeah.
But you know, we got the miracle, because in Stormont on the 21st, there was a meeting there, the DUP were there, and the SDLP, and there was a procedure that was found that could stop this legislation coming in. And there was a bit of a fray and everything in the chamber, but unfortunately, some of our leaders walked out and wouldn't cooperate with that.
Yeah.
And so we got the miracle, but you know, God cannot change human minds. We have free will.
That's true.
And so we literally got the miracle, but we're still praying for that miracle.
Good.
And we've another week and a half or so to do that. And you know, we're praying day and night.
Yes.
And
round the clock.
And people round the clock.
Yeah.
And we've been perpetual the whole time. And people have been coming from all around Ireland, and some of them coming for 12, 24 hours. Mickey Hart joined us, in fact.
You told us that. That's amazing. There for hours.
For 24 hours.
Amazing.
So, yeah, so we're really coming at this and asking God for his mercy and taking him at his word, because our Lord said, whatever you ask in my name, I will do it. And so we're asking our Lord, this is what we're doing. We're praying for a miracle, because that's the business we're in as Christians of all traditions.
Absolutely.
This is the business we're in. We're praying for God to protect the least of these among us.
And, you know, you've kind of given me a bit of an answer to this question already, but what have you seen in terms of the fruits of this initiative already?
Well, the big fruit was, as I say, we got the miracle. We're asking the Lord, we're being greedy, like you know, Oliver Twist, and going back for another one. But
sure.
We know the Lord's with us. But I think the fruit, too, is this, that in Northern Ireland, we are a Christian community, and from people from all sort of ranges of Christian tradition, from our friends, our pre-Presbyterian friends, right to the very traditional Catholic. And what we're finding is that people are rising this, even though we have divisions among us. And we have very serious divisions among us.
Sure.
You know, you know, involve the Eucharist and Mary and all of these things.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're talking about the new covenant in that sense.
Yeah.
So what divides us is very serious. What unites us is extremely serious.
Yeah.
Because as children, as through our baptism, like, we're children of God. And as children of God, we're brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
Whether we like it or not. And like all families, there's disputes and everything else.
Absolutely.
What this is doing is we're coming together as Christians on behalf of the least of these.
Yeah, so there's another miracle,
all
isn't it?
Matthew 25.
Yeah.
And we know our Lord is present in the least of these, the unborn.
Yeah.
And it's very clear in Scripture, too, that the unborn child, with the meeting of Elizabeth with Mary, it's very clear the unborn child is a person,
yeah,
right from the moment of conception. That's not only a Christian view, a religious view, it's a science.
Yeah. Well, as I said,
this is what's drawing people together,
yeah,
and rising up. Hold on a moment. And also, you know, Ronan, this is an imposition that's nothing to do with Ireland, nothing of our Irish culture or civilization. It's an imposition from the outside, this kind of ideology, nothing to do with, because Irish people love their children.
Yeah.
And everybody knows right up until the 7 months and beyond and everything before, the child is a child and the mother is a mother. And you know, Ronan, someone close to me had an abortion, and she was really terribly broken for her whole life. And it was only later on that this came to light. And just, you know, my heart breaks for women in this situation, because literally they're drawn into this, and they're lied to very often that this is not a person, this is not a child.
Yeah.
And then when it's done, you know, the damage is done.
Yeah, cast aside. So how can people find out more, Paul, and get involved?
Well, we have a Facebook page now, which has just come live, which is Prayer for Faith and Life on Facebook. So you can come there and you can see some of our contributors on there, like Nuala Lone was down speaking to us, who was the police ombudsman for a number of years, a highly respected
sure
person on all sides in Northern Ireland. And we'll be letting you know some of the other folks who are coming to see us as well. Just in the next week, you'll see that on Facebook, and on there you'll see our telephone numbers as well. So you just call us and maybe commit yourself to come up for an hour or two, or you know the overnight if you can, and come and join us in this prayer. Catholic, Protestant, anybody of goodwill, yeah. Come along and join us.
Yeah, the unity part is like another miracle. I was just saying, Paul, it's absolutely extraordinary to see, like, you know, the Rostrever Benedictines, like you were saying the last time, and then CFC and Archbishop Robin Eames and Nuala O'Loan and these various different, the Free Peas, all of them getting together, and it's just, I can't believe it, actually. It's mad, you know?
Yes, and Nuala O'Loan, bless her. There's others now to confirm, you know, we're waiting for other confirmations. But yeah, it's been very, very encouraging. And you know, as I told you before, we had a miracle before in Northern Ireland, and it was the peace process
sure.
in 1998. And at that time, everybody, all the journalists, everyone said, there's no way these people are going to agree. And then we got the miracle, and we got peace. And here we are, over 20 years later, and we have an extraordinary measure of peace in Northern Ireland, even if we still have our political differences and everything else. So that was the miracle that God gave us. And there were people praying in Northern Ireland, Catholic and Protestant. I'm thinking of Brother David Jardine, Anglican priest, who drew people together and praying. And I remember the day it came through, I phoned him up and thanked him and congratulated him. But you know the biggest thing of how we got peace?
Go on.
The people on both sides who had their loved ones attacked and killed and maimed, and many of them publicly, so many of them privately, but even publicly, we're thinking of people like Gordon Wilson, who went on to the media and forgave the people who killed his daughter.
Extraordinary.
And he did that. Now, I'm sure he was a good humanitarian, but he was a disciple of Jesus Christ.
He was.
And that was fear why he did that. And he became an ambassador for peace after that.
Yeah.
And there's others on the other side, the very same. And you know, Ronan, I think that melted the heart of God, give us the miracle and his mercy of peace in Northern Ireland. Because this society, as in the Republic, the Christian society, going back 1,500 years.
Yeah.
And so this is a witness. And I think we can be a witness to the world in Northern Ireland when a Western civilization can turn this around. Because of faith, because of Christ, because we belong to Christ.
Absolutely.
So hopefully that'll encourage everybody. But do join us in prayer. Come and see us. And if you can't come and see us, pray for this miracle that we need in defense of the least of these children and their mothers.
Amen. Paul McAree, thank you so much for joining us today. And we know that the 40 Days of Prayer is keeping going until November 15th. So you've still got another, you know, 7 days or so. So people can get in touch via the Facebook page. Give us the name of the Facebook page again.
Prayer for Faith and Life.
Prayer for Faith and Life.
We've got a great team in Dublin, by the way. Just a shout out to all the guys and girls who are helping us down there, especially Paul on the phone, who's answered phones and phoned a million people.
Brilliant.
And a good friend, John Carlin.
Great.
So,
right. Thanks a million. God bless you, Paul. We talk to you again soon.
We might have important news for you next week.
I certainly hope so. God bless you, man.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.